Good afternoon, Richard Mulcahy is my name, and this is Curiosity Radio on 103.2 Dublin City FM. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Colman Nochter, who is a child and adolescent psychoanalytical psychotherapist. That's a mouthful. He works in St. Patrick's Mental Health Service and is part-time associate professor in Trinity College Dublin. He is also presently pursuing his doctorate in psychotherapy in Dublin City University. No wonder you look so tired, Colman.
Busy times.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I suppose people are always interested how people end up in careers and things like that. I mean, as a child, were you an angsty child? Was it...
I suppose when you work in psychotherapy, there's a lot of thoughts that we maybe bring in our own stuff to work out. And having been through probably 7 years of personal therapy, I've probably uncovered stuff that was there that I wasn't conscious of when I began. But I suppose
that's a process you have to go. I assume that you're not admitting that you had to go.
Professionally, when you engage in psychoanalysis, you have to go for psychoanalysis yourself,
right?
For the duration. So, yeah, you sit in a darkened room once a week for an hour for 3 years and 4 years at a time. So
so it's actually probably the only profession where you actually have to experience it as a patient as well. Do you call them patients or clients?
There's lots of disputes about that.
Right.
in my field, it's just young people. Avoid that. But it's one of those points where you get to see the blind spots that you might have in your own, in the lens in which you hear somebody's story. So the more aware you are of your own blind spots, the less kind of side roads or channels you can go down, because I think in therapy it's you base so much on the relationship that you form with somebody that your own experience of the world inevitably affects how you hear someone else's story, the bits that you identify with or the bits that jar with you or whatever different experiences you've had. So in psychoanalysis you need to have a parallel process of going through that yourself, so you're on the other side of the couch as well, and you're kind of compelled to continue that at points throughout your career if you feel you need to, and then you've supervision, which you would do every month as well, which would be
part of that process.
So there's a lot of work behind therapy that probably people don't maybe see from the outside.
Absolutely. We'd go back to that, but I pulled you away from when you were a kid. What was your childhood like?
I was very ordinary. I would state that I kind of existed in the middle all the time. I was never really strong or anything, but I wasn't ever really weak at something. And I always think that was a protective element for me. I was never under pressure to excel, and I never really struggled that I needed an awful lot of support with something. I kind of existed in the peloton in that sense. Right. But
how many siblings did you have?
I have two older sisters.
Okay, so you were protected a little bit by them, were you?
Yeah, I mean, I was typically, I was probably your Irish only boy, youngest, very mildly coddled throughout my life, and kind of only realized that as an adult, just how, you know, my mother would peel my potatoes when I was 19 years of age. So I'm guessing there was probably some attachment issues there. But fending for yourself. I moved to London when I was young. I lived there for some years. But my teenage years were quite normal. As I said, I love sport. I played a lot of sport. I played GAA with Thomas Davis's. I played rugby with two of my schools, De La Salle Churchtown and Temple Oak College.
Nice.
And you know, still play tag rugby today, but
when you look fit.
From the point of view of it was a very, I would say it was a very ordinary childhood, but definitely having two sisters and a mum helped me with my emotional intelligence. I think we were a family that kind of talked about things and talked things out, and I always remember from my childhood, my mother always had my back, and I always remembered that positively, that even if I was in the wrong, I think she still had my back, and I'd no doubt that if a teacher ever wronged me, that she'd be the first down to fight my cause from that point of view. And I always just felt that unwavering belief in me was something that I suppose stood me in good stead. Maybe not at the time, we had our rows and fallouts, of course, but as an adult I think it really did, and it certainly has influenced my own parenting technique as a father of three now, that, you know, I think that's a really important thing to convey to children, that no matter what happens, I have this, and we'll manage.
I'm there for you.
So growing up was kind of, and as an academic, I was not good in terms of as a worker.
Just go back though, because it's very interesting what you say there about emotional intelligence. And it's not something that you could sort of tag on a huge amount of men, is it? You know, we tend to be much more physical and throwing ourselves into things.
So. Yeah, and I would have seen that in my father, who mm-hmm. wouldn't have been emotionally engaging in that way. At the same time, I always, again, felt he had my back, but in a very different way. It wasn't about a sit down and chat about it, but if needs be, he would be there. But we would, my father wouldn't have engaged in that kind of dialogue when we were smaller or younger. And so, yeah, you had the contrast of two. But I think with the three females in my family,
in your life,
and they would have been kind of teenagers and young adults as I was coming through my own development as a teenager. And I would have heard their stories from college and their dramas and all the bits that went through. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, I suppose there's a, I'd always question whether I how I ended up in a therapeutic situation, because I'd be quintessentially kind of, I like mainstream movies, I like sport, I love cars. So, it's, and you know, I remember going to college and they were saying, you know, psychoanalysts love cryptic crosswords and foreign language movies, and I was kind of thinking, that's not me at all. You know?
But you had already decided, had you, in your latter teenage years, that you wanted to do psychoanalysis, did you?
Not a bit, no. I fell into it.
You fell out, okay. How did that happen then?
I worked very little for my leaving cert and things like that, and you know, my teachers used to say, Coleman's homework looks like he did it on his lap, and that's exactly where it was done. But I suppose school, I didn't really, I enjoyed maybe English and history, but outside of that, it didn't really fit me, I suppose, from that point of view. I kind of survived it, endured it. So when I came out, I thought, I don't really want to go to college. It was something I really didn't drive me. And to be honest, I really wanted something that would give me money and finance. So I was too small for the guards. I was too scared to be a fireman. I was absolutely awful with my hands in terms of technology. I was the only person who was asked to leave tech drawing and join the Latin class instead. So the kind of only thing that was left was nursing. And my mother said, you'll never stick nursing. You don't have the discipline for it. And that was the red rag that I needed to go and do it.
But who suggested nursing in the first place? Was it careers?
My mum was a nurse. So it wasn't that I didn't see her doing the night shifts and getting up at 7 a.m. on a Sunday to do a long 13-hour shift. I knew what it was ahead of me, but it really was down to, you got £70 a week in first year, you got £100 in second year, and £115 in third year. And that really was the driving force. And I would always say that to young people who come to me, especially around exam time, and we're talking about, you know, I don't know what I want to do with my life. And I, thankfully, have ended up in a career that I absolutely love and I'm passionate about. But I certainly didn't know that from the start. I fell into this. And in doing my leaving cert, my mother had basically told me afterwards that she had me enrolled to repeat, despite, you know, before the results even came out. So,
that's an air conference, isn't it?
But that was never known to me at the time. I suppose that's the interesting part. So it was maybe a superficial belief in me. Okay. But no, I went nursing and I went to psychiatric nursing. And
as a natural progression, was it something with
straight away? I was 17 years of age doing my leaving cert, and I started in St. John of God's in Stillorgan, still 17. It's interesting because I remember the interviews for the second interview for that was on the day after the leaving cert results came out, and it was a real strategy too. You know, who was going to go out on the town the night of their leaving cert results, and who was going to be in bed by 11 getting ready for their interview? And I was one of the second, the latter half. Right. And when I got it, I suppose I was delighted. I found the first months really difficult as a 17-year-old, being exposed to the level of acute mental illness that I was. I was terrified for most of it. But I met somebody along the way who told me to kind of think about human behaviour as something that's interesting rather than something that's to be frightened of. And that I remember he said, you know, mental disorder is a difference in degree rather than a difference in kind, which is kind of, we all have, you know, it's not sane people and insane people, but rather people who are struggling more than others.
It's like a clock faces different degrees.
Exactly. Exactly. And
you grasped that. This was like a mentor, was it?
He was a senior nurse on one of the wards, and a guy that I really respected. He was very kind of genuine, warm guy. He was in the game a long time and still had that real compassion for people and treated them with huge respect. And I always used to kind of try and match that a little bit. his saying was, you know, when men around you panic, you stay calm. And that always stuck with me too. But and that, like in your nursing, you care for all kinds of people. So you're working in the care of the elderly ward, and you're working with. It all fascinated me. And you know, I remember working in the elderly ward and being told, you know, imagine that's your mum. And treat them the same way, you know, and that kind of really helped to kind of hold that. But once I landed on the young person's unit at the end of second year.
So you were 19 then?
Yeah, 19.
So you were a young person yourself?
I was, maybe 2 years older than most of the young people who were in there. And I just went, this does it for me. This is really interesting. I think I could make a difference here. And you know, I'm sure it was in fed by, you know, a rescue fantasy to make a change. A lot of people who work in psychiatry will talk about the revolving door and people coming back in, having done lots of work with them before, and how perhaps that disheartening that is as a professional to feel, am I getting anywhere with this? Mm. Whereas working with young people, I suppose you're intervening at a stage where the difficulties are only in their infancy, and there's a real sense that if we can get in here early, we can really make a difference to that person's trajectory. And it caught me from the start, and I pursued it straight after. I did 6 months after I qualified in adult and went straight to adolescence, and I haven't really worked with a grown-up since that sense. So child and adolescent mental health has always been my area of interest and the bit that got me. And I just enjoy young people's their lives. I enjoy trying to keep up with it. I enjoy trying to understand it a little bit. And but that's changed.
It's interesting you say that, you know, that they're only developing their issues. That's it. So in a way, were you looking for to get an outcome rather than something that would just drag on then? Was that a driving force for you too?
Well, they suggest that 75% of mental health problems exist at the age of 16. So they start.
That's a huge statistic,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah, when you're thinking about someone's vulnerability. And it was always about vulnerability for me. It wasn't about the disorder. It was about, how is this person viewing life? And once you begin to kind of form a lens of how you see the world, that tends to be something that's becomes quite hardwired and established in your mind's eye, and events and circumstances in your life then can always be seen through that lens. And I think it's more difficult to change that as the more established and entrenched that lens becomes. Whereas early on, when you see young people who are developing traits that perhaps, you know, they send red flags in your head about, you know, how this is going to end up, and trying to help them to see things differently. The flip side of that is, when you work in this area, you also see young people, and this is the hard part, and I think it's why people might struggle working in child and adolescent mental health, is because at times you might meet a 5 or 6 year old who already has been through so much that you don't really envisage that their world will be able to repair from that.
Much trauma in their lives at such an early age.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of severe levels of trauma, abuse, again, they will be able to recover to a certain extent, and your role in that is really important. But whether they will ever be able to undo that level of disruption sometimes, and that can be some of the more difficult parts, because I think a lot of us go into child and adolescent psychiatry with, you know, we put on the cape and say, you know, we're going to fix everything, and sometimes circumstances, trauma, family circumstances, those things are much more difficult to shift and change in reality than they are, you know, in your own imagination. And the disillusionment that sometimes this doesn't work out perfectly all the time, and sometimes you know, young people still struggle despite everything that you can do, and families still struggle, that can be hard. And that's what makes the job a little bit interesting, I suppose, from the point of view of you know, you learn from each case that doesn't respond the way in which you
maybe try
you want it to, and you just have to keep being creative around how you do that. But I think there's a sense that no matter what you do in therapy, it's doing some good, even if the outcome isn't positive. That
even
perhaps
just still listening, maybe.
Yeah, it's again being there. I think.
Yeah.
Is
tell me
aspect.
Something, just because it was a mouthful for me, and I suppose that's just because I'm just I'm not very good with words. Psychoanalytical psychotherapist. So for the ordinary Joe like me, can you explain what that actually means?
Yeah,
you're just trying to confuse me.
No, I mean, it's, again, I think psychoanalysis it tends to be quite highbrow in some respects. But it's not something that has to be, I think, in some ways. The basis of psychoanalysis that is that you believe in an unconscious, that there's an unconscious part to our mind that oftentimes drives our decisions and drives our behaviours and thoughts in ways that we're not aware of. And so when you're engaged in psychoanalysis, you're looking for unconscious motivations for why that might be the case. I suppose, for me, I think a lot of what we do, the behavioural side of it, is the tip of the iceberg. I think there literally are so many other layers of meaning to why we do what we do. And that includes, you know, your choice of career, your choice of partner, your relationships, the way in which you respond to crises, trauma. I do think there's probably unconscious motivators there that really influence that, and I think having a chance to work that out of what that might be.
I'm just trying to get my head around this. So would it be a layer back that automatically gathers information that's sitting there but not really doing much?
It's doing an awful lot, I think, in that sense.
Okay, but
we're not conscious of it.
We're not conscious of it. So it's absorbing stuff the way we were not obvious about it.
Exactly. If you meet someone in the street and you just have a vibe about that person, they haven't done anything,
that
there's something wrong, that would be called a kind of a transference, where it's elements of that person is reminding you of something in your life, and that you're really struggling to go out. And a lot of our decisions, especially when you're in a therapy situation, can be driven by unconscious motivators, and that can be positive or negative, where you know, you just meet someone, you have an allergy to being around them, and you don't understand, there's no basis for that, why, and other people you just might seem magnetized to and absolutely drawn to, and there's no explanation for why that is either. Psychoanalysis would say the early childhood years are really important. We'd say the hardwiring of the brain probably happens in the first 18 months of life, especially people who would come from a kind of an attachment point of view. And so a lot of our difficulties in the way in which we cope with life can come down to that. If you think about it, as human beings, we think, we feel, and we do. So any sort of psychiatric or mental health problem will affect what you do in terms of your behaviour. It'll affect how you think about things, and it'll affect how you feel. There's another layer in psychoanalysis, which is the unconscious, and that is the bit that probably adds another dimension. Psychoanalysis would be against kind of labelling people in terms of, you know, people with bipolar or schizophrenia, and the formulation around psychoanalysis is people with problems as opposed to problems with names. So it would work very much off that ethos of trying to understand. So you wouldn't have a kind of a pro forma way of treating someone with depression. Your view would be that this depression is unique to them, and we've got to find ways of understanding that and working with it as best we can. So
the more people that you see, the more the more of an insight you get, then would that be fair to
absolutely,
say?
Absolutely. I would think my skills as a psychoanalyst or as a therapist have definitely increased, more so from the experiences I've had of working with people rather than anything I've read from a book. And it's an example of that might be something like someone with an eating disorder who looks on the surface as somebody who wants to be thin or is fear of gaining weight. Whereas the psychodynamic look around that, it might be about a fear of growing up, it might be a fear of development, it might be a power struggle within the family, it might be their own unconscious drive to be seen or recognised and visualised. And when you explain that to people and to families, then it becomes something that they can work with, rather than it just being about food, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So what would be the most common thing you see in young people nowadays?
I think anxiety has become the infliction of the last 10 years, I suppose.
And how does that manifest itself? You know,
I think perfectionism would be one that is most common. Certainly it's something, I'm doing this since I started nursing in 95. I was in child psychiatry since 98. So you're talking about 18 years, and you see a kind of a development or a curve happening in that time. And I definitely think, you know, young people's anxiety is certainly something that is becoming more problematic. I'm on record as saying I don't know whether young people have the coping skills to match that level of anxiety, or certainly whether we give children an opportunity to develop those coping skills to manage life events in the way that perhaps over a decade ago children might have had. And that's a worry I have, that that we're becoming more stressed with less skills to manage stress or less exposures to surmountable stress, which leaves us feeling quite overwhelmed.
Would there not have been, I mean, say, like, I'm 60 now, so like 50 years ago, are you saying that there would have been less stress around, therefore less need to be anxious?
I link it to expectation. Okay. I think that's the bit that is very different. Okay. I think certainly I get a feel that young people have, there's great expectations that are put on themselves by external variables or society or parents, but there's also this immense expectation that young people put on themselves to achieve in exams, to achieve in sport, to be popular, to, you know, to make a difference. And in life, oftentimes there's many obstacles to that. That's certainly something that doesn't come easy. And, you know, things like relationship breakdown, exams that don't go well, or things that seem to be a challenge. I'm not so sure young people are equipped with the resources that maybe they would have done before to react and respond to that.
But we would have all gone through that sort of thing, wouldn't we?
Yeah, and I don't
know. Where would I have got my skills to do that 50 years ago as against now? I mean,
well, I suppose the idea that young people, and I can only go by my own experience, if something was difficult, you were left to kind of sort it out or work away. And I'm talking about a very small child in terms of reflecting on things, becoming like a decision maker is a really important skill to have, being able to weigh up pros and cons of making a decision or the risk involved in something. And I think that demands a degree of reflection, that you think about it or ponder it. And maybe you were left to do that or work that out and manage the consequences of it. I think perhaps society today, and again, I see this in my own children, the urge to do for them seems greater than to do with them, if that makes sense. And it doesn't allow them to foster the skills of managing things like boredom, like adversity, or like things that don't work out or don't go well. I'm not suggesting it's a massive epidemic, but it's just a feature of change. And with greater expectations comes the greater risk of disappointment. And the greater risk of disappointment comes with lowering our mood or creating more levels of anxiety in ourselves. And I worry that sometimes we're becoming an anxious culture.
Do you think any that has to do with globalization and the pressures of big business, you know, for people to spend money, to, you know, they're comparing, we're comparing our lives to other people, which people didn't have to worry about 40, 50 years ago?
Yeah, I think the connectedness of things that makes things very convenient also makes things very anxious. If you think of it, something like, let's say, the internet, the capacity for it to make our lives easier is great, but also the creation of paranoia of how much it knows about us is also something that's, you know, when boundaries and things are kind of blurry or not very clear, people feel more anxious. And I think maybe you can see that in worldwide events around, you know, Brexit and building walls. You know, if there's a burglary in our neighborhood or we're suspicious, we change the locks and we try and make it more safer and make our world smaller. And perhaps that's a kind of a response to anxiety globally, that things have gotten so connected and mobilized that perhaps people want to create a secure space within where they feel that's less problematic, maybe.
One of the things my father used to always talk about was the tyranny of choice. You know, you go into a super, in America, in a supermarket, you could go in and there could be 60 of the exact same product there. And that puts pressure on people, doesn't it?
Sure,
God, if I make the wrong decision, you know, this sort of thing. And that's what I mean about globalization, that there's so much out there now. It confuses people and could it create anxieties in that way?
Absolutely. I mean, if you live in a small rural town and you don't leave a 6-mile radius of that town for the rest of your life, you don't know any different. And so you might go through life very, very happily or contently. Whereas if you're another brother in that family who travels and discovers Tibet and India and the world, they have a lot more things to decide upon. And again, it's like your dad said, that tyranny of options, of making the right or wrong choice. And sometimes too many choices are overwhelming. And you'd see that a lot in children, where young people will describe, you know, feeling overwhelmed with responsibility and responsibility to make the right choices or choose.
Can they verbalise that?
Absolutely, yeah. Really? And it might come down to young people who, you know, we talk about it in therapy quite a lot, you know, the blue hoodie or the red hoodie, you know, and kind of feeling incredibly anxious about which is the right one to do and to get, and someone coming in and making that choice for them feels better. And that's why people maybe turn to something like anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder or eating disorder, which essentially makes the choices for you. You won't eat that, you will eat that, you'll check that 6 times, you'll check that 7 times. It offers us an external voice which seems to be managing anxiety, but in actual fact, in the long term, is creating it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, how can you go about trying to remove that anxiety from a young person then?
I think it's about trying to create meaning and priority. I think that's really one of the things that you've got to establish. What is important here? Mm. And in any choice, that's maybe how you work that out too. Which do I need and which do I want? And trying to decide the differences between the two. Again, you try and make them see that, you know, choosing a red or green hoodie is not going to be the result of your happiness. It comes from something else. Mm. And trying to see that a leaving cert result isn't going to define you, or, you know, a successful romantic relationship isn't going to define you, but actually getting them to believe in themselves and their own capacity, and give them the confidence to believe in that, helps them to make choices and helps them to make decisions.
Because you mentioned that when you were younger, that you like having that support of your mother and that belief in you gave you that confidence in yourself, which is a very important thing. I think I went through the same. I got a very good education with the Jesuits, and the one thing they taught you was believe in yourself, which is so important.
Absolutely, and that provides confidence. Yeah.
I'm just conscious of the time. We're going to have to end our conversation there for the moment, but it's a fascinating subject, and we'd like to carry it on for next week, if that's okay.
Great.
With you,
yeah.
Coleman. And talk about things, particularly like things like teenage sex and the internet and all that, which is a fascinating area. I'm sure you're dealing with it all the time. On behalf of me, Richard Mulcahy, Curiosity Radio on 103.2 Dublin City FM, we were talking to Coleman Nocter there, and we will carry on the conversation next week.